because they are people, and that's all there is to it, right? So it doesn't matter if, for example, choosing to respect people based on their will, their rationality, means excluding, you know, a family member that doesn't have rational faculties. That's just how it works. That's just what it is, and you follow it as a result of being human.
What if someone has less free will than someone else? Is that just not possible to have?
Not for Kant, at least. If you have rationality, you have autonomy and free will. I mean, you are an end in itself.
All right. Well, I guess that closes that book. Well, stop here just to briefly say that you have been listening to the Canadian Philosophy Show. We are halfway through our episode on the philosophy of respect with regards to Kantian ethics. We've been on a bit of a journey, and I'm not sure if we've gotten precisely where I was hoping to get to, which is figuring out what the foundations of respect should be in the modern philosophical sense, looking at the foundations of respect for persons that were found in Kant's writings.
I'm not sure that all philosophers would be willing to say that there's something different about the modern day that necessarily discounts any one view of respect or of ethics, even Kant's. Like, if you're a Kantian in the modern day, you're still a Kantian, right? And so there's nothing about the fact that we live in modernity that necessarily discounts one or another account of what respect should be and of what responsibilities that puts on us as, you know, ethical beings or beings that need to act morally or desire to act morally. And so I think that's why it's important to be talking about what is the basis of respect, not necessarily just as virtue of living today, but just in general. What do we want? What makes sense for that to be, and what will we want that to look like? Another issue I wanted to bring up, for example, is that you have some interesting moral implications on Kant's account, which I will a quote here from the same article. So, important consequences of the Kantian view of the scope of moral recognition, respect for persons as persons. We talked about the first two, but the third is, because dignity does not depend on how well or badly the capacities for moral agency are exercised, on whether a person acts morally or has a morally good character or not, dignity is not a matter of degree and cannot be diminished or lost through vice or morally bad action, or increased through virtue or morally correct action. So you can be a pretty terrible person, and you are still worthy of that baseline degree of respect. You still have that dignity that Kant accords to all rational beings, which are, you know, almost all human beings. So that's also something to consider. That's the part that bugs me the most, I think, is that I have to view with respect, that is, on the accounts that we've been talking about, people, regardless of how they act, morally or immorally, have a rightful claim on my conduct and deserve moral consideration in its own right, independently of considerations of personal well-being or of characteristics or traits. So someone that, let's say, is a lifetime serial criminal, you know, the worst supervillain you can think of, they are worthy of this baseline respect still and have a moral claim on my conduct just as a result of being human, which I don't love the idea of. There might be some people out there in the audience that are saying, yeah, that makes sense to me. You know, it doesn't, like, because they're human, they deserve some kind of respect. But when you think about it as being a claim on your conduct, that is, that you can't treat them in a certain way, or you, in interacting with them, you have certain obligations, I think feels odd. Like, I wouldn't have qualms about putting a serial murderer that has no intention of ever, you know, becoming a better person, locking them away up for life. Okay, great, that if that's what they deserve. But And you might say that, okay, putting someone in jail is not necessarily using them as a means, right? So it might not necessarily be going against Kant's idea of what respect is. When we think of the colloquial term respect, like, I don't respect you, or you can lose my respect if you do something that I see as morally questionable or morally wrong, which is not something Kant would allow. You can't lose all respect for somebody. You can only lose it maybe to a certain degree where you don't add respect onto their achievements, but you have that baseline.
The idea of human dignity today boils down to, well, and is enshrined in a lot of human rights ideas, where it's that just because someone has, you know, hurt other people doesn't give you the right to hurt them. Just because someone has caused harm to other people doesn't necessarily give you the right to harm them back. And that principle of, very simply, to do no harm is, I think, what the point of this type of respectful behavior is. Because without it, it is a lot more consistent for society to solve their own problems, so to speak. And I guess one of the problems mainly with Kant's philosophy is that he assumes that laws are always kept. Laws are not broken. Laws are enforced, and they're enforced well, and the state acts as a legitimate authority. And so in that type of situation, it's like, okay, well, the legal system, the justice system, must have respect for the sake of people who are criminals, not because of what they have done or what they have not done, but because our justice system serves all of society better if criminals are properly taken care of and laws regarding to their care are kept. There may be a case where someone is wrongfully convicted, and in that case, the government, after they've found out they have been wrongfully convicted, is then able to restore them to where they belong in society. So I think it's that type of thinking which really shows us why we need a concept of human dignity.
It's interesting because I think what's going on with Kant's ethics is a bit more, I don't want to say subtle, but I want to say a bit more wide scoped in a way. So when I read Kant, I encountered him as like a deontologist, as, you know, you've got to follow the categorical imperative, it's the moral law, and that will lead to good action. So in his essay, What is Enlightenment?, he's obviously answering the question, what is enlightenment? And he says that enlightenment is the human being's emergence from his self-incurred immaturity. Immaturity is the inability to use one's understanding without the guidance of another. This immaturity is self-incurred if its cause lies not in lack of understanding, but in lack of resolution and lack of courage to use it without the guidance of another. It's important, without the guidance of another, right? But interestingly, not far from the beginning, he says, rules and formulas, those mechanical instruments for rational use, or rather misuse of his natural endowments, his rationality, are the ball and chain of his everlasting immaturity. I read this as saying people who interpret the categorical imperative as the one rule to rule them all, that is a move of self-incurred immaturity. So the categorical imperative has to be something other than, you know, the one rule, and then you apply it all over the place and figure out what to do in every instance, because that is self-incurred immaturity. You have to figure out your own rules. So one way I've tried to resolve this reading is to see the categorical imperative as the conditions for the possibility of action at all. And weirdly enough, that reading is kind of shared by another Kantian scholar, Christina Korsgaard. So I'm just going to, this is from the end of her book, Self-Constitution, where she gives an example of what it would look like to not consider someone's reasons. And I think it's actually a useful example. So this is self-respect under a different guise, under the guise of seeing it as the condition for action at all. Consider a simple coordination problem. Suppose you and I are related as student and teacher, and we are trying to schedule an appointment. Stop by my office right after class, I say, thinking that that will be convenient for me, and hoping that it will also be convenient for you. It isn't as it turns out. I can't. You say, I have another class right away. So I have to make another proposal. It's important to see why I have to do this. It's because having the meeting is something that we are going to do together. We want to do that together. The time I suggested isn't good for you, and therefore it isn't good for us. And it follows from that that it isn't, after all, good for me. And so I need to suggest another time. But there's another thing you could do, and that is you could not see someone's reasons as reasons at all, right? Suppose I don't treat your reasons as reasons. Suppose I don't respect you. As considerations with normative force for me, what does that mean? We might think it means that the discussion will go like this. I ask you to meet me right after class. As before, that is impossible. I can't, you say. I have another class. Perhaps I just look puzzled as if I cannot make out why this is supposed to be relevant. And I say something like, well, just skip it. I don't try to work out something that's good for both of us because your reasons are nothing to me. And any objections that might be grounded in your reasons are nothing to me. I can't see why your reasons should count. All that counts is that a certain time is good for me. Obviously, we can't relate at all in those terms. So if that's how it is, no personal interaction is going to be possible. And the categorical imperative is the moral law that allows you to respect other people's reasons and makes actions like coordinating, you know, appointments with student and teachers possible in the first place. So when you say things like, you know, I feel like respecting a serial killer is a, you know, that's a tough, that's a lot to ask. That might be a lot to ask. And you might not have that kind of respect for a serial killer. But I think on the Kantian reading, it's actually that, well, the serial killer is already respected by having their misconduct kind of accounted for by the law. They are given legal consideration. They are brought into legal processes that try to punish them for what they do. We give them means for interacting with the world through their actions, and we don't disconsider their reasons. We actually investigate, okay, what were they doing? They are integrated into a kingdom of ends, as Kant would have it, where we all consider each other as reason-having beings, as rational beings. And so you don't have to have respect for them. You don't have to think of them as good people. But I think the point is that for Kant, you need to have the conditions for the possibility of interacting with serial killers. So you're going to need some institutional buttressing, like legal frameworks and whatnot. And that is the kind of respect that I think Kant is talking about.
I think that was very interesting, especially the idea of self-respect and the idea of enlightenment being facing one's own immaturity and essentially overcoming a lack of courage or the ability to self-determine your own rules.
I hesitate, while I do see, you know, the value in that account, and I do see what you're saying, and I think it's a helpful way to reconfigure this to avoid the impassable difficulties of deontological ethics and Kant's account in general. I would hesitate to attribute that reading to Kant himself and therefore to his foundation for respect. Like, I don't think that's what Kant meant. His foundation of respect is based on his categorical imperative and his moral philosophy, right? So, like, it doesn't necessarily solve the issue of, is Kant's foundation for respect valuable or not, just because, you know, we can read into his moral philosophy a little bit differently. It does help, though, I will say, because again, like, I do appreciate this idea that respect for these people who maybe are morally off the moral path doesn't have to come from us in a personal sense and be like, oh, I respect you still as a person and, you know, as a decent person if you're not a decent person, but it's respect for their humanness, their personhood at the end of it. Because, you know, you can imagine that someone who commits some crimes is not necessarily psychotic and irrational. It's that they commit crimes out of certain needs and they see that as their best option. So they're still reasonable and they still deserve to be treated with a certain degree of humanity.
I think my reading is kind of I don't know what metaphor we want to use, but I'm having to take two parts that don't necessarily or that don't naturally sit together. You know, I'm taking the groundwork for the metaphysics of morals, and then I'm taking this essay he wrote for like a magazine question. It's really short. You should read it. It's worth reading it on its own. But yeah, that's basically what it was. Some editor put out a question in a magazine, what is enlightenment? And Kant was like, oh, I think I'll answer that. I don't take Christina Korsgaard to be an orthodox Kantian. She says things about Kant that a lot of Kantians, I think, would balk at, like that the hypothetical imperative and categorical imperative are the same formula, or they're the same imperative if you think about it, which I don't actually, like, I can see the distinction, and the distinction holds because Kant is trying to account for conditional action and unconditional action. Those things have to be distinct for her account. In Self-Constitution, I don't know if it's necessary. I mean, I haven't like studied the book too closely, but I will say, yes, you're right. This is not a usual reading of Kant. Again, it's helped me to understand how it is that Kant could go on to have this idea of a plausible universal respect for all humanity. Maybe that's really all it is the kind of placating reading of an otherwise untenable philosophy.
Your example, I forget the author, but the example of making an appointment and thinking about that if you don't see other people's reasons as legitimate, then no coordination will be possible. I think that's important because I think it gets to the point of why universal respect is important, because without it, the coordination between people who have never met each other before is impossible. If we don't have some base level of respect, which isn't dependent on something that you can earn societally, we would just never listen to people unless they were part of our specific part of society. A society progresses as it searches out more legitimate reasons for the coordination of people and for the ability to communicate. I mean, you can definitely say that throughout human history, language has not always been the same thing and used in the same ways in all cultures. You can definitely say that like as language evolves and changes, it grants human beings new opportunities for coordination, for understanding each other. As we, you know, with technology, that also gives us new experiences, new abilities to coordinate, and that gives us new ways to respect each other or new reasons to respect each other.
Let's start from the assumption not that everyone deserves respect, but that no one deserves respect as a foundational thing. So you might look at Hobbes, right? State of nature, nasty, cruel, brutish, and short. Brandon's like, yada, yada, we've heard this before. Yeah. So, you know, in that system, Hobbes's view is that the only value people have is their price, basically, is how he calls it, right? It's like you can quantify someone's value based on what they can do for you and their instrumental value. Then you might think, okay, so then how do we, like, that makes some kind of sense in that you do look for things from people in your everyday life. You look for them to do things for you or to provide you with certain goods or services, or, you know, so in that sense, you do take from people, not often without giving something in return, but you do use people for certain things. And so there is a kind of intuitive aspect to that. And then you think, okay, why then do we coordinate and make laws and whatnot? It's because we've created these social contracts, right, that allow us to agree with each other, that basically make it safer for everybody. But it's because we need to be coordinated by these external forces, because otherwise we just, like, you know, rape and pillage and steal from each other. And that's just how we are as human beings. So, and there is a part of that that is, that people don't like, that's like, oh, I don't go around my everyday life thinking that, oh, if only I didn't have these darn laws, I would just go around taking from people. It's like, if you're satisfied in a sense, you don't feel those needs. And so I understand why people bristle at that suggestion. And furthermore,
I think many people would be shocked at what they do if they put on the Ring of Gyges.
Yeah, that too, right? So for those of you that don't know in the audience, the Ring of Gyges is this ancient Greek example of you have basically the one ring from Lord of the Rings that makes you invisible. What would you do if you had it? If we have social contracts to govern our behavior and we're just animals in an animal kingdom, what is the purpose of this universal respect? Or like, where could that respect come from? Or does it exist, right? So interesting to come at it from the other angle. And there are extremes, of course. You may wonder, if we're allowed to use people instrumentally, that's where we get things, institutions like slavery, right? Which are things that we've worked over centuries to abolish because we've realized that that puts people in a position of inhumanity relative to one another, which we don't want to see. And that is using people instrumentally. So does this account maybe allow for some things that is, if anything, is that baseline respect so we can avoid atrocities like that, right? So another way to look at it.
If you wanted to argue against a Hobbesian or a Hobbesian perspective like that, I think you would basically just have to appeal to self-interest. Society is better off if we give people equal opportunities to succeed. Society is better off if we give people opportunities and necessities for life. If we consistently oppress people in a way that takes away all of their advantages, that diminishes their ability to contribute to society. And so we have a better society by participating in respect. And I mean, that is basically what you were saying, where you're saying like, well, we need these social contracts. And so, I mean, the problem though with that is that if everything is a matter of calculus, of just calculating, like, you know, like, is this thing, this as the set of actions is of this value to me, this set of actions is this value to me, then you can always convince someone to be terrible if the numbers play out the right way and not enough people find out. But I think that misses the whole point of this type of moral discussion, is that to be a human being, we want certain things from other human beings. And one of those things that we want is we want other human beings not to harm us. We want a certain amount of social acceptance from them. And we want, if possible, to have a positive relationship with them, a relationship where coordination is possible. And those wants are not trivial. Like, even like the most hardened person from the Hobbesian perspective, who only cares about their self-interest, they still have social needs. They still have, because those are part of human instincts. I don't think we should underestimate the idea of, well, I think you said it yourself, Mihai, that humanness itself is asking us to have respect for individual people. You find enlightenment by essentially freeing yourself of your own self-restricted chains. I feel like for society and for humanity specifically, the ability to respect anyone, no matter who they come from or who they are, is something that we didn't have on instinct, but if that is established as a societal rule, does benefit all individuals. And it's a little bit hard to see that, or it would be if we didn't have, you know, 100 years of human history proving the point. None of our advanced technology or civilizations would have been possible without that type of respect and coordination.
Kant has this, what he calls the second formulation of the categorical imperative. He says that it is functionally identical to the first formulation, you know, act only on that maxim which you can will to be a universal law. He also says, never treat another human as a mere means to an end, but as an end in it themselves. You can treat humans as means, just not merely as means. Like, go to the grocery store and there's my cashier, and I kind of just use my cashier as the person who, you know, rings up the debit card, sure, but I don't merely treat them as a means, or as a means to my end. I, you know, I speak with them, so I fulfill the conditions for interacting with them in my and course cards reading, but also in the commonsensical reading of, well, I'm just not rude to them. I actually treat them like a person who's there, who's doing their job. I can step into their shoes and imagine myself as working a job and having to deal with people who are miserable most of the time. So I can consider them while treating them as a means to my own end. I can treat them in an end in themselves. There's also a distinction that kind of popped into my mind when you were talking about the use of slavery. And it's that when Aristotle defines a slave, he defines them as a human seen as an animate tool. Now, I don't know if when you are using a tool, you are instrumentalizing the instrument. So when you look at people who use humans as slaves, under this distinction, you aren't really seeing them as a human. So that's not like I'm trying to introduce a distinction between treating a human like an animate tool and using a human instrumentally, because I think that slavery it's worse than treating a human purely instrumentally. It's not treating them like a human at all. And so that would be, I think, what violates the second formulation. You treat them merely as a means to your own. The way that you use a shovel to dig a hole, and then when it's broken, it's broken. You just throw it out.
Be cautious about under-inclusiveness when you look at this view of respect. That's the thing, that there are ways to read into it, but I think if you're going to come up with a baseline formulation of universal respect on different terms than Kant's today, I would be careful about under and over inclusiveness. So does it include all human beings? Do you want it to include all human beings? And does it include things that are not human beings? And is that good too? So for example, didn't get into it in this episode, but you might say things like respecting nature is something that is really, we're really conscious of today that we weren't as conscious of before. A theory of respect, does it include respecting the environment and nature? Is that part of that universal basis? Seems like some people believe it should, and maybe it should. But then again, do you respect it differently than you respect human beings, or on the same basis? And is it included in this universal formulation of respect, or is it something different? Is it, because people would say treating the environment as a tool is exactly the problem. So maybe you want to treat them with something intrinsically more than instrumental value. So just some notes to think about for people that think about this post episode.
Thank you for tuning into the Canadian Philosophy Show, and we'll see you next time.
Find the Canadian Philosophy Show at tcps.podbean.com and on Apple Podcasts and Spotify. Please email us at hello@philosophyshow.ca.